an equivalent amount toward rebuilding families and communities. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Africa Now. Today's show features contextualizing the protests in Kenya. Africa Now is next. Welcome to Sharmuiza Muntali. The music in the background is Ulisema by Christine Kamau. Since June 18, Kenya has witnessed nationwide protests against the government's proposed tax increase, mismanagement, corruption, and more. The youth-led or Gen Z demonstrations forced Kenyan President William Ruto to abandon the IMF-inspired and supported tax proposal and fire a majority of his cabinet. According to Kenya National Commission on Human Rights, the police used excessive force to clamp down on the protests that has led to over 50 deaths and over 600 arbitrary arrested and over 50 missing people. In the face of this crackdown, the protests continued. Today, Africa Now continues from a brief discussion on the recent nationwide protests in Kenya. The conversation dissects the social, political, and economic context behind the protests, such as youth unemployment, the role of the IMF in budgetary decisions, corruption, Kenya's relation with the U.S., and more. To contextualize the protests, yesterday I had a conversation with longtime human rights activist and lawyer Maina Kiai. Maina Kiai is the former Director of Alliances and Partnerships Program at Human Rights Watch. He's also a former UN Human Rights Special Rapporteur. He's also a founder of the Kenya Human Rights Commission NGO and founding chair of the Kenya National Commission on Human Rights. Here is the conversation. Maina Kiai, welcome back to the show after a long hiatus.
Thank you. Thank you, Muiza. It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a long, and you're there in Nairobi. If you could give us the situation, the atmosphere, what it's like to be there right now, it's particularly in this last 1 month and a half or so since the demonstrations that have been taking place.
You know, it's actually been a very exciting time. In Kenya, it's the first time that we have seen a young people come out in large numbers and young middle class peoples, the kids of middle class professionals coming out to demonstrate. It has been very horizontal, with no one quite knows who the leaders are, what it is, but it's also been very well organized. It's been extremely peaceful. One of the major things that these young people have done is given the country hope again. There was a time, the last few years has been a time of hopelessness. There was a sense that William Ruto and his people had totally dominated the country. They could do anything they wanted. They would lie with impunity. They would take, and then they were so arrogant about it as well. They were flashing their wealth. They were flashing their ostentatious living. They were just so in your face, like almost asking us, so here we are, we're now in power, so you guys just grin and bear it, you know? And so this was a sense of hopelessness. The opposition was confused and befuddled. The institutions were under the control of William Ruto and his people. So it looked like where is the next sense of how the country is going to move? And then these Gen Zs, and not just Gen Zs, I'll call them the youth of Kenya, came up. And they've given us hope again. They've given us hope that there is a future that we can actually challenge. that what is important in democracy is not just having periodic elections, but what happens between elections and how you can force accountability between elections. That has been the major part of it. So right now it's a bit of a lull. People are licking their wounds. They've been beaten. The killings by Ruto have been intense. He's been very rough. The police have been nasty. He brought out the military for the first time ever in this country, despite all the civil turmoil and unrest that's been there. We've never had the military out on the streets. It came out this time. There've been abductions and there've been killings and arrests. So it's been a very, very rough in terms of the response of the state. And still, William Ruto keeps lying. He just can't help himself. I don't think there's anybody who's such a psychopathic liar like that man. He cannot tell the truth. I don't think there's a drop of truth in his blood. And he is just incredible. He's incorrigible in so many ways. So he tells us things that are completely lies. Now he's out right now on a campaign. He's like campaigning for elections again. He's traveling across the country. He's launching village cattle dips and small things. He's out there making promises all over again, cattle dips and stuff like that, and markets coming through. So he thinks the way he can keep control is bribing people with promises. And so we'll see how it happens. But this is not over yet. There may be a lull, but it's not over yet. And I think the response will come as more and more investigations happen, as the organization, civil society and others continue investigations about how many people are dead and where they are. Today, there was reports of at least 50 people found shot in the city mortuary, dead and in the city mortuary. So we don't know what that happened. So there's a lot of unanswered questions that people are investigating. So, hey, we'll see what happens. But it's a different country. It won't be the same again.
Yes, and you said it's a different country. It won't be the same. In particular, some of the things that you highlighted was the role of the youth, what they're calling the Gen Z movement. But if we can also highlight the trigger to ostensibly the demonstrations were against the tax bill which was being proposed by the government, but it was bigger than that. It was actually
absolutely.
I mean that it was big, that was just the trigger. But if you can explain and if you could dissect to us that why that was such an important trigger, the tax bill.
Okay, so as you said, it was a trigger. The number of the grievances people have had is really the youth of Kenya have had is high unemployment and really, really no chance of getting employment. A lot of promises being made both during the campaigns for the presidential election and after. We're being told that this is happening. Third, a complete sense of the country witnessing utter and open corruption. Unbelievable things are just disappearing. Report after report since Ruto came in of corruption. Then we are seeing waste, the kind of living large that you can't believe. That Ruto comes to America and he hires a private jet. He can't even take Kenya Airways, the national airline. He hires a private jet and then he laughs at us. So there's an arrogance which they were telling things. You have ministers telling us they have a watch that's worth $10,000, $20,000 on their wrist. They're wearing shoes. And people have become smart. You look at the shoes, they go online and they match it. And you find a person's wearing shoes worth $3,000, $4,000. And is happily showing us in a poor country because he's a minister. The sense of impunity and arrogance and real, what can you do anyway attitude to the people of Kenya. And that's going on. People are not seeing any hope going up as well. Then he comes up and says to us, he tells Kenyans, look, we're in a problem. We have a crisis, financial crisis. Things are not good. We have to tighten our belts. So he's telling us to tighten our belts. He's not tightening his. We're getting budgets that are telling us he wants to spend $3 million renovating his state house. It's been renovated 3 years ago. 3 years later, what are you doing? Then he tells us that we're tightening our belts and we're seeing him living large. So the straw that broke the camel's back was that then saying that because we have all these problems, we will now tax you more. And people are feeling at the end of their tether. Taxed more. The internet generation, which makes money from TikTok and YouTube and stuff will be taxed for some, they're going to be taxed for some things, get some money out of it. Just, you know, bleeding the stone dry. It was impossible. So there are two ways in which you can deal with a crisis, a financial crisis. One is you can cut off the fat, cut off the waste. They didn't bother. And every single time they're complaining about it, they say, we have debt. Yes, we have debt, but they have been borrowing debt. By the way, the amount of debt that Ruto has accumulated in the last 20 months is almost as high as Kenyatta, who was a debt maniac, accumulated in 10 years. It's not functional. And he wants to blame Kenyatta all the time, who, in my view, does not, you know, was is the source of the problem, to be honest. But Ruto has not solved it. He has, in fact, he's exacerbated it entirely. So that was the thing that people said, this is enough. We're telling you, we can't pay more money. We are taxed to the bone. And you're still doing this. We've told you, they don't listen. So they said, okay, maybe you'll listen to us protesting. And that's one of them. The second thing, I think, around the same in context-wise, is the fact that the international community, let me be clear here, international community here, meaning the West, has taken up Ruto and embraced him and owned him. And they feel very happy with him. And he's the one who's the source of all our problems. And in a sense, we're feeling that the West is creating a new Mobutu. And that is unfathomable for us. You know, you have your own Mobutus. Take him. If you want him, take him. Take him to America. Let him lead your country. You don't put him on us like this. And then even this, to be honest, even this non-NATO ally designation they want to put, it's scary to people because now we're in the front line of this new Cold War that's beginning, which we weren't before when we were non-aligned. Why do you do this? What's the benefit? But the William Ruto is so desperate to be embraced by the West, by white people, that he will do anything for it. He will sell the country for a song to get the embrace of the West. So it's all those things combined. And then his lies. I mean, I have never, ever seen a person who can lie with such a straight face. Never. He is uncanny. He's actually would be a good study case for psychologists and psychiatrists. He lies without batting an eye, and he lies openly. He knows he's lying. We know he's lying, and he continues. It's unbelievable.
Again, that's Maina Kiai. He is a longtime human rights activist, a lawyer. He's talking to us directly from Nairobi in Kenya. We're contextualizing the protests. Movement in Kenya that's taking place as we speak. And as we're talking about how we're going back, you mentioned Kenyatta, and I wanted to also emphasize that's Uhuru Kenyatta, since there have been two Kenyattas in Kenya.
Yes,
Uhuru Kenyatta, who was the recent past president of Kenya, who was the son, of course, of the first president of Kenya. But also, as you were talking about the West, and it's something that I wanted to expand on, because this is has always been an ongoing situation in Kenya. The relationship with the West has always been there. When you saw it, even under the first president of Kenya and beyond, Moi again, as well as Kibaki and Uhuru. I mean, the West always had. Financial and military connection with Kenya. If you could elaborate a bit more on that, because it's also becoming an issue recently with the British military installations in Kenya.
Well, it's always been there. That's true. But at least there was a pretense of being non-aligned in the time of Jomo Kenyatta, in the time of Daniel Moi. In fact, Kibaki was the first one who said, look, let's look east as well. So Kibaki was the first president to basically say publicly, we need to expand our options. Uhuru Kenyatta did the same thing. He also opened up to the east. So even though they are basically at the foundational level pro-West, they were also clearly trying to balance the alignment with expanding trade and relationships with the east. Ruto has no such pretense. He's purely Western. But and never have we ever had a president or somebody in power here basically say, come, build bases, real bases in Kenya that are NATO-like bases, where you put your troops there anytime. Even the British at least pretend that their base is a training camp for them to train for different circumstances and different terrains. They never tell us they have a base where they're basing their soldiers, like the way they have in Djibouti. Look, even a country like Djibouti, with all those bases that it's got, has bases for every country. They have an American base, a French base, a Chinese base, a Russian base, and a Turkish base. You know, if you're going to do this, then go all the way that way. You know, so you don't expose yourself the way it is. So you think about this non-NATO ally that Kenya is supposed to be now. That means if things go haywire between the United States and China, United States and Russia, Kenya's a legitimate target completely. And what are we going to do? Have a few jets there to, we don't have a shield to do like these other guys have, the real allies have got. And what's the benefit for us? We don't see it. There's so many things happening. And the other thing as well, I've got to say, that is making people quite annoyed is the idea that Ruto now is actively expanding, trying to get young Kenyans to go and work abroad. And is, of course, the major place that is at is not the West. It's actually Middle East and the Gulf states. And we have horror stories of how people are treated in the Gulf and the Middle East. So he's sending people. He won't say, go, 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 go. And so people are telling him, you know, why should we go? We want to be here. This is our country. Why are you chasing us away from our country? Why don't you revitalize the economy so we can be here? And why are you stealing so much? So these things are, they're linked. I mean, the West is, you know, I suppose the West controls all the financial levers for now, and you don't want to be in bad books with the West, but you don't have to open yourself and strip naked and bend over, do you? You know, which is what he's been doing.
Yeah, and then also, as you talked about the going up to the West, one of the other issues has been the deployment of the police, the Kenya police, to Haiti. At the urgency or at the bequest of the United States. And if you could talk to us a little bit about how that is viewed in Kenya, particularly the role of the police in human rights violations historically.
Uh-huh. Again, it's part of the part of cozying up to the West. So the Americans need black people on the ground in Haiti. Ruto volunteers our police officers to go. They have no idea how things work. And I think actually what they're there now, some have landed. But I think the period in between where people were debating it in Kenya and arguing it out in court has been helpful because it's given the police and the authorities time to get this better off and understand this is not an easy task ahead of them. So that's been good in that sense. But you know, again, for us, when you talk about human rights abuses, the police are number one in terms of human rights violations. They killed. We saw them. We have been seeing them killing innocent, peaceful protesters. They have been shot and killed, tear gassed. Our police have one tool: bully, intimidate, beat you up. That's one tool in their toolbox. One. So you're sending these people to Haiti, and you're thinking they're going to spoil our name out there. The second thing about our Kenya police is that they are the masters of extortion. Everything, single thing that's passed, every law that's passed that has to do with police, you know, it's a new avenue for bribery, a new avenue for extortion. They are the masters, and they just can't help themselves. So you're thinking, oh my goodness, they're going to go to Haiti, they're going to start extorting. That's what they do. I mean, we have a police force in this country where recruits pay the recruiters to join the police. So they don't join so they can serve. They join so they can make money to pay off the debt that they had to pick to join the police, among other things. So that's where the problem lies. So we were looking at it and thinking, my goodness, why are we sending police out there when we shouldn't be? We should be doing something that's more useful to our Kenya police. And of course, you know, look, I have very little regard for the Kenya police. And I know that the West has been funding and trying to work on quote-unquote training our Kenya police for more than 30 years on protecting human rights. And there's not a single sign that you can see of improvement. So they still, now they've got better equipment. They have those water cannons that they spray pink water, which is laced with dry with some chemicals in them. They have got better forms of self-defense. They have got those, which call them ninja turtle suits. So they protect themselves against peaceful protesters who are not violent against them, but they still have them. So it's a whole new thing, and we don't wish people ill when they are there, but you hope that all this talk and discussions will at least make our police, when they are there, a bit more hesitant, a bit more circumspect, a bit more respectful of the Haitian people. Because if they lose their respect for the Haitian people, they will be as damaging to Haiti as those gangs are.
And of course, Haitian people see this just really as an extension of the U.S. Control of Haiti. Most activists have been very much against the deployment because they see it just as a continuation of all the international deployment by the U.N. At the bequest of the United States, which have historically had a very bad, bad record in Haiti. Haitians see, you know, this type of deployment as a continuation of the U.S. Manipulation of the situations in Haiti.
Yes, and it's correct. I think they're correct. I think the, you know, the Americans don't want to put boots on the ground. They've stopped doing that. They want somebody to do their dirty work. They've asked Kenyans to do it. The Kenyans are happy to serve the American master, so they do it, and they get money out of it. The one thing you have to recognize about William Ruto, he doesn't do anything without money. His other object is money. So whatever the U.S. has promised for this operation in Haiti, and I'm sure as hell that some money will be pilfered by people there. I am sure.
So for this, for him, for President Ruto, it's not a trying to really help Haitians, but it's just to help his pockets and his friends in high places, their pockets.
Correct, Muiza. William Ruto has never done one thing for the public good since he joined the public arena soon after he finished university. His history is all about personal interests, always. So I personally have never seen any track where he has done something for public. So whether it is Haiti, it's in Kenya, his primary consideration has been himself. And so I look and I read and I see, I saw an article the other day in Foreign Affairs saying that that they think the best way of handling this for the American government is to double down and help. You know, the fundamental assumption they're making wrong is that William Ruto cares about the public. He doesn't. And once you get that quickly, then you'll see things in a better perspective.
It's interesting they say that because that reminds me of 30, 40 years ago, the similar situation with, you mentioned Mobutu Sese Seko of then Zaire, of course, now Democratic Republic of the Congo. They say the similar thing. There was that slogan that says Mobutu or chaos, you know, in the State Departments where they say, well, we have to support him. And you see the similar, you're seeing the similar mistakes being made about Kenya
absolutely. I know the approach of, yeah, yes, he's a son of us, but he is our son, you know. That seems to be the approach. And so it has been done. We saw it in Mobutu. He was the best example of it. And America breaks its back to support these tyrants who have no concern for public good. But they say the right thing, they do the right thing for the America, and that's what counts. America will come to regret this love affair with Ruto.
And what do they see that they keep emphasizing this issue of Kenya being a partner in the anti-terrorism fight and the fight against terrorism, and of course there's a drone base in Kenya to targeting Al-Shabaab in Somalia.
Correct.
Yeah, and this has always been so. In the past, has been the Cold War issue in the 70s, 60s, 80s. There was a Cold War issue, and then we have now the terrorism. So the terrorism is the new Cold War language.
Yes, in a sense it is. And then now the other thing as well that is adding to the counterterrorism fight is the idea that, if you're following what's going on in West Africa, where previously regimes that were friendly to the U.S. are being overthrown and independent leaders are coming in, and they are basically telling America, no, we can't have the same relationship. So now they are jumping. Who is going to be our friend? Who wants to be our friend? So part of it is also the fear of that, first of all, Russia is creeping back in, China is creeping back in. So there is a sort of a Cold War going on in that traditional way. It's not yet been declared a Cold War. But Africa, remember, Muisa, that Africa is the last bastion for raw materials. And that within Africa, and there's a lot of reports even in Kenya saying that there's a lot of these raw materials that are needed for the next generation economy of electric cars and electric stuff, all those things. They say it's a lot of it. Congo, we know, has a lot of it. And there's all these rare earth minerals and other things. So there is going to, and so as the Chinese come in and as the Russians come back in, there is a sense of competition by the Americans. But again, they're doing it exactly the same way they did during the Cold War with USSR. They're doing it by bribing the leaders, not working with the people of the country. And that's the biggest mistake. And again, to be frank, that's what the Russians do. They don't work with the community. They work with the leaders. That's what the Chinese do. So at the end of the day, Africans are just pawns to these great powers that think we are not humans, that the ordinary people can be bought. All I need to do is make sure the leader is in my pocket. I give him money and then we can do whatever we want. And these guys agree. So that is the mistake all of these people are doing. So as far as I'm concerned, in the way that the US is dealing with Africa, I don't see much of a difference between US and China and Russia. I don't. They treat us both, all of three, treat us the same way as though we are dispensable, you know, human beings.
Now, it goes back to what you were saying earlier on about the, in this context, in the sense of the Gen Z movement that's organizing the demonstrations. Where do they see the geopolitics of the issues in Kenya?
Well, I think there's a much more sophisticated understanding within this youth of Kenya than people think. And you know, and I think one thing that what I'm finding fascinating is the fact that they have achieved so much on their own without older heads, more experienced heads. They've done something just organizing themselves through social media and through internet-based apps that older people have no clue. So I have a lot of confidence in them, to be honest. To achieve what they've done has not been achieved by many, many generations. Yes, they're going to make mistakes. And yes, they will make mistakes. But by and large, they have done fantastic work. So yeah, I have confidence. So the people I've talked to, they are very nuanced. They are learning. They're actually doing a lot of reading and watching of clips to understand what's going on. They are quite sophisticated. And the difference to a large extent between them, or the youth, I'm calling the youth, and then older generations like you and myself, Muisa, is that they have largely grown up in an era where there was freedom of expression, there was much more openness, there was less fear than there had been than those of the people who grew up in the 70s and 80s went through. Because since the late 90s going on up, people in this country were being brought up with, you can criticize the president, you can do things, you can have access to a lot of information. Since not just now newspapers and television studios, you've got the internet. So they are much more sophisticated than we were at their age. And they have far less fear because they didn't grow up with fear. As you know, being a Malawian from the times of Kamuzu, Hastings, Banda knows, you grow up with fear, people whispering all the time. They didn't grow up whispering. So they're a different commodity. And they have mastered the internet completely. They've mastered these tools of the internet. I'm sure there's a lot of people who are mastering artificial intelligence that you and I probably have difficulty with. Hey, they're a different breed and they're doing well. So they are much aware about the international dimensions. They are as aware as we are, put that way.
Yeah, exactly. As you're saying, I remember, and as we talked from way back in the day about how, you know, even when you're far away, you couldn't, you were so worried about speaking to anyone because of the intelligence system, the police system that was put in place, which appeared, which sometimes we gave it more power than was probably there, but it was appropriate because of how, the damage they did to society. They did instill fear that was real, real fear.
Yes, and absolutely. Yeah. And one of the things that they have tried to do with all these abductions, and sometimes in plain daylight, is to try and institute intimidation and fear that we can come for you anytime and we'll do it. So that is the tool that authoritarians and dictators have is fear. They simply do not have the capacity to monitor everybody, even though they want to. They don't have it. So the way they control people is through fear, that you then self-censor, you then self-moderate, and you begin whispering. But these Gen Zs, my friend, these young people, they are still shouting. They're holding their X spaces loudly. You can tune in if you want. They say it as it is. So that is backfiring on them in terms of trying to create fear. It's not working.
You're listening to a recent conversation that contextualizes the protests in Kenya with longtime human rights activist and lawyer Maina Kiai. Maina Kiai is the former director of Alliances and Partnerships Program at Human Rights Watch. He's also former UN Human Rights Special Rapporteur, and he's also founder of the Kenya Human Rights Commission, NGO, and founding chair of the Kenya National Commission on Human Rights. The music in the background is Winds of Change by Jimmy Duludulu. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation. And that's going a continent wide. I mean, you've seen the movement in Senegal. You've seen the movement all in the other places as well with this new generation. And as you said, you said that also the other thing that I was trying to, if you could expand a bit more, you said also the movement is also horizontal. There's not one leader of the movement. It's just horizontal. If you could explain how the genesis of this, because this movement didn't just start in June. These are people who have been organizing for a while now.
Well, it's a bit historical, and actually, it's also quite international. If you look at a lot of the Black Lives Matter movement, it's very horizontal. Yes, a few people. You can't actually pinpoint a leader who makes the decisions. This is not Martin Luther King Jr.'s era where he was the leader and calling the shots. No, these people are spread out in the cities. So Black Lives Matter has been a huge inspiration. And it's not just that, the Occupy movements, also very inspirational, spread out so that if you catch somebody, you're not going to stifle and kill off the movement. So this is, this I'm saying, these are pretty sophisticated people and have been doing reading and doing their research and catching up. So you had the situation where there were protests in, 15 different cities and towns in the country at the same time. Or people are protesting here. The other group is there in the middle of Nairobi, two different centers to split up the police. And you can't tell who is. There's no leader you can say, if we arrest this leader, if we take out the head of the snake. No, it's nothing like that. It's just, it's horizontal. And people are discussing and they're talking and it's very consensus built as well. So it's been good. But I think the anger has been building. I think a lot of these young people are really, really frustrated by Ruto, that he told them that he in his campaign, he pretended he was going to support them. And then all he does is going back to the same old, with a vengeance too. So there's a lot of anger in that sense, but it's horizontal. And that is a different way of organizing than people have organized, people of our generation used to organize.
And so even when we're talking about the leadership, we're talking about, of course, the traditional leadership, we're talking about the executive, the presidency, the government in power, the ruling party, the governing party. But then you also have the other component, which is the opposition groups in Kenya. You have the people like Raila Odinga and others who are part of the established political class. How do they see themselves in this new Gen Z movement? Do they see themselves as part of it or outsiders?
Oh, I think it's clear they're outsiders. In fact, the Gen Zs the youth of Kenya, when they started, kept, they sent a message to Raila Odinga, say, please stay out of this. This is not your thing. You've done your bit. Stay home. Let us do this alone. But these you know, people like Raila Odinga have been so used to dominating that space, especially of protests. He was the master protester, the master organizer, and that space now has been taken. So he's fumbling and he's making huge mistakes, so much so that he has succumbed and gone off and sent four of his key lieutenants to join the cabinet of Ruto. So he's, in a sense, it's good. One of the benefits of these processes is that Raila Odinga, who has occupied that space of opposition for so many years, is now has eased himself out of that. He's no longer within the opposition. He has messed himself up quite a bit. And is the respect people had of him has deteriorated a lot. So, you know, he's 80 years old. I think he needs to move. He's trying to move on to the AU. We wish him good luck. But I think the sooner he leaves this country's processes, the better it is for Kenyans. The other opposition are trying to find their way. They don't know how to deal with it. They are, you know, they don't have, if you don't have a history of protesting and standing up, it's a bit harder for you. But I think this is a new era, and everybody will have to find space. I think this may be the beginning of a new dispensation within the governance system. If the youth decide they know what to do and how to do it, they are very, very clear. For them, this is not about waiting for elections. They're saying, you know, hey, if we can get rid of Ruto before, then we should go for that. And let's see what happens in the country. So they're different. And so the clever opposition leaders are supporting them and supporting them in as much as they can. So there's been fantastic support, by the way, from the Law Society of Kenya, which has been taking up the cases of people arrested and bailing them out and defending them in the courts. It's fantastic support from civil society who are doing documenting, following them to make sure that things are being exposed and stuff like that. So there's been a good turnout. But this is clearly the youth of Kenya's moment. And all the rest of us should do is support them. Not try and take it over, not try and govern it, not try and direct it. Let them do what they're doing.
And speaking of Raila Odinga and the African Union Commission, if we could expand a bit more on that, he wants to be the head of the to take over the chairperson usually rotates between presidents, but the person who actually runs the African Commission, he wants to become the head of the African Commission. Right.
Correct.
And is he, do you see them, do you see some of his decision making and actions being affected by that, because he's been busy closing up to the present government?
Correct.
Ruto.
Correct. Ruto. Absolutely, Muiza, you're right. That he's so keen on, you know, the way that authoritarians grab you is that they focus on something you want, and then they start playing around with you on it. They dangle it on you, and then you kowtow. So part of it is that. But the other part of it, I think he himself does not know how to cope with an amorphous movement that he's not controlling, does not know where they want to go. So he would rather be where he would rather have something that he can manipulate, be involved in, influence, than something he can't. So part of it is his own personality, I think. But yeah, of course, be wanting the AU thing means he's going to make pact with the devil, and that's what he's done, and it's going to cost him. You know, these things have consequences.
And finally, before we go, I wanted you to also dissect how people here in the USA, ordinary people in the USA, can be in solidarity with Kenyans.
The one of the things that can be done is put pressure on Biden and his team to loosen the strings they have with Ruto, that it's in their interests to take a more nuanced pro-people approach than they have done. That it's that tying, putting all their eggs in the basket of Ruto is not going to help America, and it's certainly not helping Kenya at all. And that needs to be quite clear and quite it's quite urgent, in a sense that this idea that they want to create a new Mobutu is dangerous both for Kenya and for the US. So loosen those strings and those ropes that you're holding us with. Secondly, it's to put pressure on US to get the IMF to be clearer about what they're doing with Kenya and their prescriptions, what is actually happening. Third is to figure out where this money is that we now understand is in Dubai and Qatar and the Middle East and Gulf states. We've got to find a way to end the secrecy and the opaqueness of the banking system there and be able to, because it's going to hurt everybody in the world with that opaqueness and the reports. Those of you who have watched the Al Jazeera show with the diamonds of Zimbabwe, they all go through Dubai. It's the new capital of illicit and illegality. So there's a lot of stuff that can be done, and also just support Kenyans in their people, the people as opposed to the regime. Always differentiate the people from the regime. If you support the people of Kenya, you're never going to get it wrong.
Maina, thanks again for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be with us again.
Thanks, Muiza. I appreciate it. And you take care of yourself out there.
And all the best to you too.
And thanks. You too. Thanks, bro.
You've just been listening to a recent conversation which further contextualized the recent protests in Kenya. The conversation dissected the social, political, and economic context behind the nationwide protests. Issues such as youth unemployment, the role of the IMF in budgetary decisions, corruption, Kenya's relations with the United States, and more. The conversation was with longtime human rights activist and lawyer Maina Kiai. Maina Kiai is the former director of Alliances and Partnerships Program at Human Rights Watch. He's also a former UN Human Rights Special Rapporteur, and is also founder of the Kenya Human Rights Commission NGO and founding chair of the Kenya National Commission on Human Rights. The music in the background is Gurima by Chinawiso Marere. Now the show features Gen Z movement voices who took part in the protest of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. The protest on July 20 at the IMF headquarters in Washington, D.C. was organized by Kenya Diaspora Voices. Here are the voices at the demonstration.
May the IMF knew, and they knew very well, that pushing bill was going to lead to civil unrest, but they kept doing it. And William Ruto, who is so determined to please his Western masters, he is a puppet. He decided that, you know what, this is important for him, for the IMF, than it is for Kenya. And we want to tell the IMF today that the 53 deaths are on you. Our agenda on them, Sindio. What's her name? Julia Koza came on TV to tell us that she is sorry. Julia, we want to let you know that we do not accept your apology because they will not bring our dead back to life.
Yes.
Julia Koza, pack your bag and leave Kenya. We refuse your agenda and all this debt forgiveness. No, that's not what we want. We want an entire cancellation of our debt. Tamaje, wangu kenayo, sindio?
Viva Kenya, viva!
Viva!
Kenya wapi?
Juu!
Kenya wapi?
Juu!
IMF wapi?
Si!
IMF wapi?
Si!
Thanks a lot, fellow Kenyans. Thanks a lot, fellow Africans. Thanks so much to everybody who is here to be with us today. First and foremost, my special condolences to the 53 Kenyans and probably many more Kenyans. We are still discovering bodies out there. These are our young heroes who had the bravery and courage to stand to power. Young Kenyans who have seen how the direction our country is heading, and they got the courage to ask the authorities, the powers, why are you doing this to us? And for that, they were killed. We need to be angry enough, friends. And if these words reach out to those Kenyans who are not here, I'm saying we need to be like thousands of us here. The next thing I want to say is this. Kenya, I'm telling the IMF, I have a message to the IMF. Kenya is not your plantation.
Yes!
Practices that you pursued. We've been with you for more than 50 years. Africa, South America, Asia, the Global South. We have seen your comradeship. We know what you're doing. And we have seen you. You can no longer hide. This is Gen Z. These are millennials. These are Kenyans who understand what is happening. You cannot continue to hide. The other thing I want to say, you have a history of discrimination. Today, they come to Africa and they give us this list of conditions to meet. And maybe some of you don't know, they just started giving loans to countries at war just the other day. This never used to happen, but now it's Ukraine. And we know the marriage that is there between the West and what is happening in Ukraine. But when we are at war, when we have our own troubles, they don't come to us. So, what I'm saying is this. They are more than ready to tell us to forget our Linda Mama programs. They are more than ready to tell us to reduce our health expenditure. They are more than ready to tell us to reduce our expenditure on education.
Oh.
Ruto must
go.
When Ruto assumed power, he had a couple of things he could have done to improve the Kenyan financial situation. He had some low-lying fruits that he could have gone for.
He knew there was a lot of wastage. He did nothing. We continue with the same wastage. We continue with unending benchmark trips overseas. We don't know why they're doing it. Kenya is deteriorating day after day. We need to say an end to all this. His gang of ministers, his thug ministers, they are stealing right, left, and center. And they don't have, they're not even ashamed of vomiting in front of our feet, showing us those trinkets, expensive trinkets they wear. The other day, Ruto himself was given, he told us, somebody in the Middle East paid for his
That's bribery.
He needs to come clean. Yes. We all know, we are Kenyans, we know. Hakuna fair ya fili. What is it you're doing? We need to be fair. What is it that we're selling? There's no free fair. And you know what you're doing.
You've just been listening to voices from Gen Z movement voices who took part in protests of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. They were in solidarity with demonstrations that have been taking place in Kenya against the IMF proposals for tax increases in the country and also other structural adjustment programs that the IMF has been pushing in Kenya and other countries. The July 20 demonstration at the IMF headquarters in Washington, D.C. was organized by Kenya Diaspora Voices. The music in the background of the protest voices was Get Up, Stand Up by Bob Marley and the Wailers, Fight the Power by Public Enemy, and Opposite People by Fela Kuti. Early on in Africa Now, you heard longtime human rights activist and lawyer Maina Kiai contextualized the protests in Kenya. The music in the background is Opposite People by Fela Kuti. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Mwiza Mutale. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shahanana with Zain Al-Amin, which looks at issues in the Middle East and Northern Africa. And that's followed by Women's Collective, Sophie's Parlor, which is also followed by Human Rights and Justice with Nkechi Taifa. And that's followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, which is followed by Kombitla Kai with Eugenia Charles, which looks at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers Michael Nasella and Kalia Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers Chanda Kozer and Fonan Gonda, and the Africa World Now Project Collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Oderson. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Rambe by Rita Marley, commemorating her birthday, which is July 25th. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe.
Us all around to diverse parts.
rocking up the same street. So no matter what they do, no matter what they say, all I do.
For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. Republican Carrie Lake won the Arizona GOP U.S. Senate primary yesterday to face off against Democrat Representative Ruben Gallego in November. Lake, a former Phoenix TV local news anchor, won the endorsement of former President Donald Trump as she won 55.4% of the vote to fill the seat set to be left vacant by departing independent Senator Kyrsten Sinema. After her primary win, Lake called Trump bulletproof and said he's a hero as she thanked him for his endorsement. Democrats currently hold a thin majority in the upper chamber, meaning the race to replace Sinema could play a key role in deciding the Senate majority. In other news, dozens of massive wildfires burning across the western United States have forced thousands to evacuate, and forecasters warn another potentially record-breaking heat wave will soon trigger further fire risks. Some 89 large fires burning across the West are impacting air quality. Among them is California's fifth largest blaze on record, the Park Fire, which grew by tens of thousands of acres per day in under a week. Meanwhile, the Quarry Fire in Colorado has forced the evacuation of about 600 homes near Denver. Oregon had 31 large fires as of this morning, and Montana, Utah, and Arizona each had 6, according to the National Interagency Fire Center. Climate change-related factors, including heat and extreme dryness, plus land management policies, have enabled the spread of wildfires. Some areas burned by the Park Fire saw their single hottest 30-day periods on record just before the blaze broke out. In news from the Middle East, Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh was killed early today after attending the inauguration of Iran's new president in Tehran. Hamas and Iran both blamed Israel, while the Israeli military declined to comment. His death threatens to deepen the war in Gaza to a region-wide conflict and raises fresh doubts about Gaza ceasefire talks underway in Rome. Iran's supreme leader said it was his country's duty to avenge the killing because it occurred in the Iranian capital, and Hamas's armed wing warned of major repercussions. Jordan, Lebanon, and Qatar condemned the killing of Haniyeh. Jordan said the killing will lead to more tension and chaos in the region, while Qatar described it as a heinous crime, a dangerous escalation, and a flagrant violation of international and humanitarian law. And in a report released today, the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights said thousands of Palestinians have been detained by Israel in violation of international human rights and humanitarian law. The report said Israel's prison service held more than 9,400 detainees as of the end of June, and some have been held in secret without access to lawyers or respect for their legal rights. They are mostly men and boys, but some women and girls as well. Among them are doctors, journalists, and human rights defenders. The report includes allegations of torture, such as waterboarding, sleep deprivation, and electric shocks. UN Human Rights Chief Volker Türk stressed that international humanity